Coming up on episode 188 of Wheel Bearings, we're driving the 2021 Honda Odyssey Elite and 2021 Ford F-350 Lariat with 6.7-liter Power Stroke diesel. We talk about Sabine Schmitz, Volkswagen Power Day, and Jeep's Easter Safari concepts. On top of all that, Rebecca calls in from the road with more big Wheel Bearings news. That's all ahead on episode 188 of Wheel Bearings.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
And I'm Sam Abu al-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And later on in the show, we'll have Rebecca from wherever Rebecca is.
From a secret undisclosed location somewhere that's not here.
Yeah, an above ground bunker. That.
Yes.
Yeah. all right.
And actually, she won't be alone either, so that's good too.
Yes. Ooh, a tease. Let's talk about what we're driving. I'm assuming, Sam, you found uses for the 2021 Honda Odyssey Elite. I had this just a couple weeks ago. Did you take trips, go to IKEA, anything?
I didn't make any trips to IKEA. I did go over to my daughter's apartment with some tools and other stuff to help her out with something. And, for this particular task, the Odyssey was perhaps a little bit of overkill. Could have managed it with our Civic, or actually almost, well, not quite with the Miata, but
with a trailer with the Miata, right? It's
absolutely yeah, exactly. But so I had the Odyssey Elite, which is the latest and greatest version. It's got the 280 horsepower, 3.5-liter V6. This one was clearly built earlier in the 2021 model year, probably sometime last summer or early fall, before Honda lost one of their suppliers for this vehicle, because the Elite and I think a couple of other trim levels are available with a really cool feature, which is the Honda Vac, which is a vacuum cleaner built into the back, the left rear corner of the cargo area. If you've ever had children, and if you have transported children in your motor vehicle, you would definitely understand the appeal of having a built-in vacuum cleaner, particularly a shop vac, right in the vehicle, because especially with youngsters, there are always scraps of stuff, crumbs and stray French fries, whatever else. Yeah. Not having to lug a vacuum cleaner out, plug it in at try to find all those things and scoop them up before the rodents and vermin get to them, or nasty smells occur, is very handy. Unfortunately, I mentioned shop vac in there. Unfortunately, during the course of 2020, the pandemic, shop vac actually declared bankruptcy and stopped production of all of their products. And so Honda announced a few months ago that they were discontinuing that option, simply because they couldn't get the shop vacs. They are actually working on getting another supplier for that. Bankruptcy, this was a Chapter 11 bankruptcy for shop vac, not Chapter 7. They are going through a reorganization. They may end up, restarting production at some point. Whether or not they do restart production of these vacuums for Honda remains to be seen. But if you are interested in a minivan with a built-in vacuum, you know, there are no, almost certainly some Odysseys still out in inventory and dealers' lots around the country. So I would definitely recommend, if you're looking for a van, that you look for one of those.
I thought the Pacifica now has a vacuum in it as well. Either one of the competitors.
Maybe the Sienna? Sienna is brand new.
Yeah, I think somebody else is offering a vacuum as well. And, you know, it's a good cleaning tool. And with kids, it's a great threat when they hit that age and they start to bicker. It's like, listen, I will suck the last breath out of your lungs with that vacuum if you do not stop.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I wasn't going to go down that dark path. But, you know,
we have a little edge out here.
Yeah. But aside from the vacuum cleaner, you know, the rest of the Odyssey is fairly conventional. You know, currently we still have three and a half kind of main competitors in the minivan space. We've got the Pacifica from Chrysler, the brand new Toyota Sienna that just launched. Both of those, interestingly, are available with electrified powertrains. You've got a plug-in hybrid in the Pacifica. You've got a standard hybrid powertrain, non-plug-in, in the Sienna. And then there's also the Kia Carnival, which is the replacement for the Sedona, which is going sort of slightly more crossover-ish, but there's no hybrid powertrain in that one either. And that's a relatively low volume player in this market compared to the other three. So the Odyssey is kind of the last one that is sticking, at least for now, with just a traditional gasoline powertrain. The current Odyssey, it just got a refresh for the 2021 model year. It's probably got another 2 years, you know, two model years to go before it gets a complete replacement. And I would guess at that point that it will probably get an electrified powertrain option of some sort, either hybrid or plug-in hybrid, because the Odyssey shares platforms with Honda and Acura's other bigger utility vehicles like the Pilot and the MDX. The MDX already offers hybrid systems in it, as well as the Ridgeline pickup truck. So for now, you're stuck with the 280 horsepower, 3.5 liter Honda V6, stuck, which is an excellent engine.
That's right. Stuck. I mean, yeah. Come on. it's a good
car. The reason I say stuck is, while I love the Honda V6, it's a great engine. Even with the 10-speed automatic that's in this thing, I didn't get outstanding fuel economy.
Yeah, was it in the teens?
It's officially rated at 22 combined by EPA, 19 city, 28 highway. I was getting about 18.
Yeah, that's about what I got with that, 18, 19, yeah. Something like that.
And, you know, so that's not great, especially, you know, when you consider what you can get from the competitors, from Chrysler and from Toyota. Aside from that, you know, the rest of it, you know, is really great. Honda was the first one to offer the interior camera system that is also available on the Pacifica now, that has cameras mounted in the headliner, lets you keep tabs on what's going on in the second and third rows, you know, and display it on the center touchscreen. Again, if you've got young kids, you know, especially if they're really young, you know, toddlers or babies that are in a child seat. I know when my kids were little, we would always get you know, one of these little convex mirrors, yeah, that you mount, you know, on the sun visor or somewhere, you know, so you could try to see what's going on in the back. And it was always obstructed, and, you know, it was never a great view. Plus, you couldn't really see much in the dark either. With the, you know, the camera system that's in here, you know, you get a clear view of what's going on in both the second and third rows from overhead, so you can see, you know, if the kid needs some help, or, you know, if there's some undesirable interaction going on between multiple siblings. Yeah,
I did like the surveillance abilities because it also has night vision mode, so it'll flip to IR, so you can see stuff like you were talking about in the dark. You can see how things are going without having to turn on a light and destroy your night visibility.
Yeah, and there's also a communication system that, you know, with microphones in the ceiling that lets you talk. You know, if one of your kids decides they want to sit in the back, the third row, be away from everybody, you can still talk to them back there without shouting at them, things like that.
Did you try it? Did you try it with, like, Daisy? Put Daisy in the back and call to her or anything? Like,
yeah, no, I mean, she doesn't really respond to stuff like that.
so I tried it out. It makes you feel like like an old time PA announcer. Like all I can think of is the Lou Gehrig like farewell speech, like today.
The echo.
You can hear it's a tight echo. It feels really strange. I think you get used to it, and it probably will help if you've got people in that third row consistently. But for the second row, it's more of a little gimmick. But it's a thing I think that's kind of spreading. Mm-hmm. Honda's not the only one that does it. I think Toyota also does it.
Yeah. And it's useful. This is something we're going to see in a lot of vehicles going forward. You know, what these systems are doing is they know what audio is playing on the, you know, what audio that the system is producing. So if you're listening to the radio or something like that, and you say something, you want to interrupt, in the case of some vehicles, you know, using a wake word for a voice assistant, you know, it knows what's playing. So it can mostly pick out your voice out of that and actually interrupt what's going on. And then, you know, so you don't have to press any buttons or anything like that, which is really handy. You know, it's everything you can do to reduce the distractions for the driver, you know, trying to find the button or things like that. I think that's a real benefit. I personally, you know, no longer have a use for that. Right. You know, my kids are adults and gone. But I think, you know, I know that when my kids were younger, I definitely would have loved to have something like this when we were doing road trips.
Especially if you can turn it up and make it real loud and get their attention. But it is one of those
things. You can also add some bass and reverb to that, you know, like the voice of God in there.
Like, you need to stop. The hardware's all there.
Do I have to pull over this car?
Do I need to make it flood down there? There's already mics in there for the phone. You know, there's already the audio hardware, and all the systems are integrated now. It's not like you need to patch one to the other. You need some kind of switchboard. So it's interesting the things that have been made possible by the way vehicle electrical systems have become networked. And really, like, it's all just one big computer network. And it is, really. It's like a phone system. If you wanted to get it into, like, if somebody's listening on the headphones, I'm assuming it'll drop your voice into the headphones, depending on, you know, because you can, with these, you can get multiple.
If they're
sources.
Using the rear seat entertainment system with headphones, it'll patch into there as well.
Yeah. So it seems like a silly little feature. And then you think about what you have to do to pull it off, and you, as with so many things, you go, that's actually pretty clever. And it took some time to sort that out. And if it's not useful, don't use it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's virtually a no-cost thing for them to be able to add.
Yep. One other thing I did notice about this, you know, after being in a number of more recently introduced vehicles over recent months that are getting larger and larger screens, the 8-inch center touchscreen in the Odyssey seems minuscule by comparison, especially like I was just in the Lincoln Nautilus a couple of weeks ago. There's a 13-inch display in there. The 8-inch display in the Odyssey just seems so quaint now.
Well, and Honda doesn't help themselves out with graphics and UI that's a little bit behind the curve as well. It seemed responsive enough when I had it. I don't know how your experience was with actually using the system. I was just at least glad that it's not that two-screen knob controller touchscreen business they had not too long ago.
Well, that was only ever in Acura anyway.
Well, maybe that's what I'm thinking.
I never did those in the Hondas. That was an Acura exclusive, thankfully.
You have to pay more to suffer.
Yeah.
Honda, their digital systems, they've been difficult to use. I found in the Odyssey, at least, it's easy enough to use. The system isn't great. It's not that deep, so it's not that hard to get used to.
The interface is fine. It's reasonably responsive. It didn't crash or anything on me. Didn't do anything silly. It does have support for Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, but both wired, no wireless support yet.
Yep.
So it's a decent system. I can live with it. The Elite that I had the Blu-ray DVD entertainment system with wireless headphones available, leather trim inside. One of the unique features of the Odyssey that you won't find in any other van, to my knowledge, is the second row seats that slide both forward and back and side to side. With the second row seat, you've got two seats in the second row, you know, two captain's chairs, and you can either spread them out to the outer perimeter and have a walkthrough in between to the third row, or you can slide either of the seats to the middle position. So you can walk through on the side. So in the old days, you know, when I was young, when minivans were still a new thing and they only had a door on one side, it typically had the second row seat was moved over towards the driver's side of the vehicle because the sliding door was only on the passenger side. So you could get through to the third row that way. Now with doors on both sides, you can actually slide it back and forth, slide both of the second row seats side to side as well, which is can be a very handy feature depending on how people want to sit. If you want to have your a young child, you know, a baby or a toddler in a child seat in the middle position, so that, for example, a parent in the front passenger seat, not in the driver's seat, but a parent in the front passenger seat could reach back and attend to that kid. You know, you can have them in the center, or if you've got older kids that you want physically separated a little bit, you know, at least by, you know, 18, 24 inches, you have that option as well.
By an arm span. You know, the nice thing that you can teach those kids when they get a little unruly is that you can unlock the side-to-side sliding and then go around corners, especially S-curves, and they kind of... I don't recommend it as a responsible thing.
I didn't realize
but it's
you could do that. If you could unlock them,
I think so.
While the vehicle's in motion,
I think you can. Unless it was one of the other. There's. I'm trying to remember which vehicle it was that we played around with it like that. It wasn't the last Odyssey we had, but I noticed that it does have the you can spread the seats out a little bit, which is helpful. But it was a couple years ago. I remember you can unlock the side to side sliding, and then you go through some S curves, and it's like whack, whack, whack.
All right.
Yeah, we entertain ourselves. How did you think the interior quality was? Because that's the Elite, and so it's supposed to be the nicest. And I felt my biggest gripe about that was the interior is nice, but it doesn't feel as nice as the nice interiors in other vans. I'm thinking particularly of the Pacifica because I haven't been in the Sienna yet. But also it's loud. Like those were my two biggest gripes about it.
Yeah. The interior in the Odyssey is nice enough. You know, you get leather seating. The materials are generally, you know, good all around. Honda's pretty good about that. But compared to say the Pacifica Pinnacle, especially, the newest high end version, but even like the limited models they've had in prior model years, it's not on the same level as the Pacifica. The Pacifica, you know, I think I haven't been inside the new Sienna yet, so I can't say for sure. But the Pacifica, I think, is really the or at least it was the class of the field up until just now with the Sienna and now the new Kia Carnival. The Carnival actually looks really good too. So the Odyssey's not quite on that level, even in Elite trim. And then it is louder than the others. That, you know, the V6, you know, sounds really good, but you do get more of that engine noise coming through and a little bit more road noise coming through. The Pacifica is definitely feels more refined on the road overall. And so that is something to keep in mind. Now, if you're interested in something that maybe feels a little bit more sporty, like you're interacting with it a little bit more, you're getting more feedback from it.
Yeah.
Then the Odyssey is perhaps maybe the better choice for you. Cause I think either the Pacifica or the Sienna, you know, particularly the Sienna, you know, because it's standard hybrid system is generally, I think, going to be a little more quiet. And then the Pacifica plug-in hybrid is also obviously very quiet most of the time. So I think that the Odyssey is definitely more of the, it's got more of the traditional Honda feel to it.
Yeah, you know, I agree there. Alive. I really did like the way the chassis actually feels. This thing actually feels a little sporty. There's steering feel here, which was really surprising. So it's good to drive. It's just around town is better than on the highway. It's got a little road noise on the highway that gets fatiguing. But
the Odyssey Elite that I drove was priced at $49,335, including $1,200 delivery charge, $1,120 delivery charge.
Being a parent is expensive.
You know, is not cheap, yeah. But it's, you know, it's in the same ballpark as recent Pacificas I've driven. So it's certainly price competitive. And I think the last Pacifica Pinnacle I had may have been even more than, I think it was up into the 50s, like into the low 50s. So these vehicles are, like all vehicles, are getting more expensive to buy. But, you know, you do get a lot for your money.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, too. I think if they're going to push into the $50,000 tier more aggressively, they're going to need something like the hybrid, like, you know, or more luxury. Maybe an Acura version would help them get there. I doubt it.
I don't see an Acura version of the an Acura minivan coming anytime in the foreseeable future. If they replace this with another conventional Odyssey, there will certainly be a hybrid and probably a plug-in hybrid version available. But one thing that just occurred to me is the possibility that Honda actually has a deal with GM. They're getting two electric vehicles from GM off the Ultium platform, one for the Honda brand, one for the Acura brand. And they've described them as crossovers. But given the way that the minivan segment has continued to shrink over the years, I wonder if what they might end up doing is replacing the Odyssey with something that a battery electric vehicle that is perhaps a little more crossover-like, you know, kind of the direction that that Kia has taken with the Carnival as they replace the Sedona. You know, they've given it styling that is a little more crossover-like. You know, it's still, you know, clearly very much a minivan, but Kia is not even referring to the Carnival as either a minivan or a crossover. They're calling it an MPV, a multi-purpose vehicle. So I wonder if Honda might go a similar path and use their Ultium vehicle as a replacement for the Odyssey.
It's not a bad move. I mean, it's not like the minivan is really all that different from a crossover. It's just, it's almost like the difference is in the top hat, really. So
yeah.
We'll see. GM has never really been super successful with vans, so maybe it's GM hardware and Honda cleverness.
Yeah, it's going to be a GM Ultium skateboard,
right? Which doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and then a Honda top hat on top of that.
Well, we'll see. Like they're due. Everybody else has refreshed their vans, so. The next Odyssey will be hopefully a leap from this one.
All right. What'd you have?
So I had another Ford truck. I had the F-350 Super Duty with the 6.7 liter diesel and the Tremor package. So I've had enough of these now where I can kind of go off the top of my head and say the diesel's going to cost you $10,000. The Tremor package is upgraded suspension and skid plates. There's 1,000 plus pound feet of torque in this thing, so it is absurdly quick with nothing in it. It's just like, it's a solid axle truck, so I believe it's a solid front axle as well as a solid rear axle. So a lot of, you know, like your F-150s or 1500 grade trucks will have independent front suspension, so they behave a little better. This is a little bit more stiff, a little bit more old school, but it behaves pretty well. If you get it over broken pavement, it'll jiggle you around a bit because it is a little stiff with the Tremor package especially, but they've got enough sway bar in there to make it corner better than you imagine it should. So it's a good truck. The new F-150 is the standard for Ford, so you know, what's already out there in the Super Duties is going to be brought to that level when they refresh it. So look for a larger screen and different materials and design and stuff.
Over-the-air software updates and
yeah,
all that good stuff. yeah, I'm just looking at the Super Duty specs. The 4x2 F-250 and F-350 still have the classic.
The 6.2?
Red is old. Twin I-beam. Front suspension system.
The twin I-beam, which is like, my dad's F-150 had that's negative camber all the time because it just wears.
Yeah, the twin I-beams, you know, were basically, you know, essentially really long control arms, you know, where the pivot point for the left wheel would be over to the right of the engine, and the pivot point for the right front wheel would be to the left of the engine, you know, so they're going across.
Yeah.
So it's almost like two independently pivoting beam axles, the solid axles for each front wheel.
Yeah, I never understood the geometry behind that, because it always seemed to me like with such a long lower control arm, you get weird. Well, you do. You get weird camber going on with it as it goes through its
well, you're actually going to get, because you've got such a long pivot arm, you're going to have less camber change.
Oh, okay.
Because if you think about it, you know, think about where the pivot point is. You've got from that pivot point, the radius out to where the wheel is actually moving. You know, if you think about the arc of a circle, a longer radius circle, it's going to be flatter through that region where the wheel's actually moving up and down.
That makes sense. It's just then, I guess what happens too is like whatever the I don't really know what the twin I-beam front suspension looks like to service. I left home before the truck needed to be worked on. but that upper control arm, I don't know. I always just remember seeing the Econolines going down the road, and they were like, they're set up to rally. They always had the sort of saggy looking front end. Where they'd wear the inside of that front tire.
And then for the 4x4s, like what you had, the Tremor, it's got what they refer to as a mono beam coil springs.
Mono beam. It's called a differential. Also known as
a solid axle.
Right. we stuck a Dana 44 under there, or whatever it is. It's a rugged truck, and it's designed to work. So a lot of the features are designed around that. In the bed, it has the, I forget what it's called. It's like Ford Connect or something. So it's got the system where there's four basic anchor points, and then they're like cleats, and you can get the accessories that go across the bed and stuff like that. Motorized running boards, which we've talked about before. Super handy because it is it's a tall beast, and we are fun-sized people. So it's difficult to get in without it. I'm just imagining uses for that diesel.
Did you manage to pull out that stump yet?
No, I haven't pulled anything yet. We've been ferrying kids around. We took it skiing though.
You could just relocate your house with that
thing. I could. I'm trying to imagine like what you would use that much torque for. And I just told a friend, I was like, let's go steal some RVs. You could just hook them up and boost them. Like they're not going to catch you. Even if you get in a police chase, it's not going to care that it's hauling an RV, you know, it doesn't care for a 5 or 10,000 pound RV. It's not going to matter.
F-350, 4x4.
The 4x4 may have reduced your towing a bit.
Well, the single rear wheel is 15,000 pounds. The dually is 20,000 pounds.
Yeah, single rear wheel is what we've got in the drive. I haven't had a dual rear wheel press car in a long time. that's a lot of weight. That when you think about what normal people tow, like that's a lot. And I know that the Super Duty isn't designed just for normal people, so that's part of it.
That's actually conventional towing.
With fifth wheel or gooseneck is more?
With a fifth wheel, F-350, 4x4, single wheel is 22,400 pounds. Dually, you can go with the 4.1 to 1 rear axle ratio.
Oh, man.
35,400 pounds.
Okay, so...
So you could pretty much take your house.
I don't know if my house weighs 35,000 pounds. I haven't calculated out what a house weighs.
if you go to the 450, the F-450 dually rear wheel drive, 37,000 pounds.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out where that gulf is where you actually need a commercial license versus just your regular driver's. And maybe it doesn't matter when you're just an individual towing something too versus like towing for, you know, backhoes for like construction.
I think that there is a threshold, you know, based on like vehicle class. I think, you know, certainly class 5 and above, I think you have to have a commercial driver's license. So that's like over 14,000 pounds gross vehicle weight.
Oh, yeah. So this probably doesn't get there. It's probably not quite 14,000 pounds. It's not a light truck, but it's not that heavy.
The weight classes are based on gross vehicle weight, which is a combination of curb and payload.
Right.
So the curb weight for the 350 diesel single rear wheel is 7,300 pounds.
Oh, it's heavier than I thought. Wow.
Is it? Did you have a short wheelbase or long wheelbase?
I think this is
long wheelbase. It's 4x2.
Oh, it's only 4x2 with the long wheelbase.
Looks like it. Or that's the super cab. Sorry, you had a crew cab, right?
I had a crew cab. Yeah.
So crew cab. There are so many combinations.
I know. We're going to be here all day.
It's just nuts. But yeah, it's still 7,700 pounds for long wheelbase 4x4 with the diesel.
That's heavier than I thought. And it is a tuna boat. It's a little difficult to maneuver in tight parking lots because it is kind of long.
Yeah.
But that's okay. So then its payload is
about 3,000 pounds. Class four is 14,000 to 16,000 pounds.
Yeah. See, it doesn't get there.
So, yeah. So I think class five is over 16,000 to 19,000 pounds. So that's, I think, where you have to have a commercial driver's license. I think a class four, you can drive without a CDL.
I don't want somebody towing 30,000 pounds without knowing what they're doing behind me.
Yeah.
In front of me, that's fine. You do whatever you want.
What's the heaviest trailer you've ever towed?
Not anywhere above maybe a couple thousand pounds. I haven't even towed a car. Like, not any appreciable distance anyway. Like,
I've towed a 12,000 pound trailer, and that is it's an experience. I mean, you do need some training before you do that, especially, you know, on mountain roads.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you know, I did this during like a decade ago on a GM heavy duty truck launch drive in 2010, and it was in West Virginia, and so one of their engineers, you know, gave me a lesson in how to drive and maneuver with a 12,000 pound trailer on the back. And there's a lot more momentum there. Once you get up to speed, you have to be really careful. Fortunately, modern trucks like this Tremor and, you know, all the other modern trucks, one of the cool new features they have in there is trailer sway control.
Yeah.
Because when you get a big trailer like that and you're driving down the highway, and if you get a crosswind or something like that, or even just small motions of the vehicle that get that thing moving back and forth like a pendulum.
Yeah, it starts to amplify as you correct. And
it does, yeah. And so all the modern trucks have trailer sway control standard on there. So it's looking, it's basically an extension of the stability control where it's looking for motions of the vehicle relative to what your actual input is. And if it detects it starting to sway, it will actually start applying the brakes on the rear wheels, or maybe the fronts, or maybe all four.
Opposing to it, sort of steer it?
Yeah, so it'll start pulsing one side to the other to try to stabilize it and get it back under control again. And it works really well.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the kind of things that and integrated trailer brake controllers, like back in not too long ago, those are all things you'd have to add to the truck. And now they all have it. This even has an exhaust brake because it has the variable nozzle turbo. So it can just close it down and give you that sort of back pressure that slows it down with compression. So it's set up to work. So it feels kind of ridiculous driving around, like, you know, just taking the kids to dance. Mostly what I've been doing as I take one of the kids to dance is I've been explaining we've been using the B&O audio system, and I've been explaining the Fletcher Munson curve to her, which is, she's into music now. And so, is explaining the different mixes and things she hears, because she likes like 80s music. And so I can explain some things, and I'm just like, why do you like that song? Why do you like that band? They suck. So we'll put on the phone and I'll just skip things. She's like, why are you skipping it? I'm like, I hate them. So the Fletcher Munson curve is the frequency response of the human ear plotted against sound pressure level. And they cross at about 85 dB. And that's where your ear sort of flattens out and has the most even frequency response. So I was explaining, I don't know if my 15-year-old understood it, but she liked it when we played stuff loud.
Well, that's the thing about being a parent is, you know, you're free to explain things like that, whether they, you know, understand it or care about it.
Yeah, it gives me a chance to just explain the things that excite me. So I've been explaining the difference between chamber and plate reverbs and stuff. It's like, oh, that's a chamber. I like chambers. Chambers are chaos.
As an audio guy, let me ask you, I'm less attuned to, you know, subtle differences in sound quality.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll detect gross things. Like I've got one pair of wireless earbuds that sound okay for listening to podcasts, but as soon as you put on music, you know, the base and, you know, even the lower mid range is really muddy and just sound, they're really awful. And they actually happen to be B&O, but that's a whole other story. So I'm curious, you know, as somebody who is more attuned to sound than I am, what did you think of the B&O system?
It's well, and that was, I think, sort of where I was going is like, it's good once you get it up in that sweet spot. Once you get it playing loud enough to sound decent, it sounds decent. It's car audio systems tend to always do the boom and sparkle thing where they have overemphasized bass and high end, and there's that scoop in the middle. We used to call it the smiley face EQ curve back when you had graphic equalizers where you'd boost the low end and the high end. And that's sort of something you do when you play it at lower volumes when you're not putting out that kind of sound pressure. That's basically your loudness switch on your old receiver, and it does the same thing. It sort of lifts up both ends of the frequency response, so it sounds more full when it's not moving as much air. I'm not a real fan of the B&O systems. Otherwise, they generally they're okay. I overpaying for car audio systems is a thing now. Like, they'll give you the branded system, and it's all fancy, and it's, none of them sound really good across generally all brands. There's a couple that impress me, but it's such a crappy environment for audio anyway.
Yeah.
Like, you're
well,
not,
that's the thing. You're right. It is a bad ambient environment because there's so much other stuff going on.
You got noise, you got resonance. Like, the car is made out of metal. If you're going to build speakers, you don't want to build them out of sheet metal. You want to build them out of like roofing tile, like the terracotta, something dense, you know, like lead. You don't want to build them out of. That's why so many speaker cabinets are MDF, because it's much more dense than even like some kind of hardwood, which it's just going to resonate sympathetically and it's going to screw you. And there's, you know, that's a very deep rat hole.
But the thing is, like you said, you know, almost every automaker is offering branded, you know, premium audio systems, or, you know, what they call premium audio systems in their vehicles now.
Yeah.
You know, Ford used to use Sony. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, they announced that they were switching over to.
Did not like the Sony systems. I didn't.
They
remember
switched over to B&O Play, which is actually different from B&O. Like Bang & Olufsen, the company Bang & Olufsen, they originally established the B&O Play sub brand, like, I don't know, a decade ago, as their like more, their more mainstream, lower cost brand. And then after a few years, they sold it off to Harman. So it is yet another Harman brand.
Yeah. Harman is one of those that, like, they basically own car
they're,
audio.
They're
car
like the Luxottica. Luxottica owns all the eyeglass brands. Harman owns most of the car audio brands.
They do. I think one of the independents is still Bose. And, you know, I've talked about Bose, but their stuff sounds different, and it can be pleasing. Bose stuff tends to be kind of warm and mushy, so it has that more impressive sound at lower volume levels. Bose, their tech tends to be like, we took all of these tiny little speakers and wired them together so that they work like a giant speaker. You're like, that's great. So I phase artifacts, because anytime you've got lots of crossovers and electronics going on, like, the thing you hear. And even when you use an equalizer, you don't hear the equalization. You hear the phase artifacts that of what you're doing is more what you're doing. So in studio gear, like, we talk about, well, I could do this and it was really clean. Because there's two different kinds of EQ generally. There's FIR, which is finite impulse response, and IIR, which is infinite impulse response. FIR filters, it's a lot more math. And I think I may have this backwards, but they sound cleaner, and you can actually be more surgical with them. So if you actually want to use it as a correction versus an effect, you know, the older stuff that everybody likes that has a tone, well, it has a tone because it's full of artifacts and stuff. So that's all we're really listening to in an automotive environment, is like, what vibrates, what interacts with other things. You're off axis. I hate surrounding cars. Absolutely despise it. It always just sounds weird to me. Unless you have something that is surround encoded, and then it moves it to the right place. But I don't like it. I'm picky.
Yeah. Well, some of these, you know, modern infotainment systems have, you know, they've got DSPs in there. They're creating all kinds of different sound fields.
Yeah.
you know, like the Volvos and Census, you know, one of the options is this concert hall surround, which always sounds really weird.
It sounds hollow. It sounds because it's, yeah. it's adding a little bit of ambient. It's adding a little bit of reverb basically. And so that messes again with your frequency response. It's a little bit of pre-delay and a little bit of reverb on the backside. So pre-delay is it delays what goes into the reverb. So you get that distinct, like the actual impulse, the actual sound. And then as it enters the reverb, there's a delay in between there. And then you've got your reverb tail. And I don't know. I don't honestly want to listen to a car that sounds like I'm in a church. Like that's just too much space around me. And it's funny to play with the modes too, and just watch how it just collapses when you hit stereo. And it's like, well, here's how everything actually sounds when we're not fiddling with it. Here's what the drivers do. And if you want good car audio, you need expensive drivers. You need a lot of power and you need a lot of sound deadening. And that's why like something like Dynamat works pretty well, but you have to use like jute on top of it because Dynamat increases the mass of the panels so that it doesn't vibrate. It's basically tar paper you put on the back of your panel so that panel now you've increased the resonant frequency of it. And you've got to do all that stuff to make car audio good. No automaker is going to do that to the degree that I'm going to want because I'm so picky. I do like how Porsche does, like they actually integrate the enclosures and stuff into the structure of the car, which is clever because it doesn't take up space. You're not like putting a speaker enclosure somewhere. You're designing a cavity in the unibody.
The thing that we're going to start seeing in the next few years, and I've gotten a few demonstrations of this now from Hitachi, and now that division of Hitachi or Clarion was acquired a couple of years ago by Forcia, a big automotive supplier, is this idea of actually eliminating the traditional speaker driver and actually mounting actuators on the backside of various surfaces of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Using those surfaces as essentially the speaker cone, and actually, you know, at least, you know, stationary, it actually sounds surprisingly good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the I'd love to hear that because that is sort of, you know, when you get a source like that, when you get it to radiate, you really do get a sense of the sound just being part of the ambient surroundings. And then all you have to do is figure out how to package the low frequency stuff, how to package the subwoofer.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that, you know, you can do with that is, like, for example, put actuators in the seat.
Yep.
And, you know, in the headrest. And they're, you know, they're much smaller than traditional speakers, a lot easier to package. And you can create little sound bubbles around each individual seat. So individuals can listen to different things without disturbing each other. And also at the same time, have decent sound, you know, and not have to use headphones. So I think it's a really interesting approach, and we'll see how, you know, how people like it. But in the demos I've had, it actually works shockingly well.
And I derailed the podcast. I'm sorry.
All right.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just a couple thoughts on Sabine Schmitz. For those not familiar with her, you know, she was a race car driver. She grew up near the Nürburgring. Her family owned a hotel adjacent to the Nürburgring. So she lived in that area her entire life, and, you know, has driven there for decades. She was 51 when she died. She was one of the most successful race car drivers on the ring. She won the 24 hours of the Nürburgring twice and won countless other races. Among her other things that she did, you know, the many things that she did during her lifetime, was being a ring taxi driver. You've probably heard about, you know, going and driving on the Nürburgring. They have a bunch of public days, you know, when it's not closed for automaker testing or for races. On the public days, you can pull up to the gate at the Nürburgring, pay, I don't know what the fee is now. When I was there, it was about equivalent of about $20.
What?
And literally anything that you're driving.
Wait. It's why do we not do that here?
Product liability lawyers.
I don't. But they're German. They've got no shortage of persnickety lawyers.
So you can literally pay the fee, take a lap of the ring, and whatever you've got. The first time I did it was in an Audi 90 rental car in the mid 90s. It was a front wheel drive, manual transmission. And when I got off the track, you know, I got out and took a look at the tires, and they were just completely feathered. There was smoke coming out of the brakes. It was hysterical.
And it's a rental, so you just hand it back that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you're not inclined to drive it yourself and you really want to have the Ring experience, the other option you have is taking a Ring taxi. And they have a fleet of BMW 5 Series, I think it was M5s mostly. And you can ride along with a professional driver that knows the track. I mean, this is a 13.5 mile long track, 120 some odd corners. I drive it all the time in Gran Turismo now, but I've driven it a few times in real life, and it's a phenomenal track. It is the kind of track that would never get built in the 21st century because it's incredibly dangerous. Many people have died there. But Sabine Schmitz, you know, one of the things that she did was she was a Ring taxi driver. And I would have loved to have taken a lap with her. I never met her, but I have had the opportunity to ride shotgun a few times with other race car drivers, including at the Nürburgring. Back in 2010, I went on a trip with Buick for the launch of the Buick Regal, which was being built in Germany. It was based on the Opel Insignia. And part of the drive, we went to the Nürburgring, drove some laps around the Nordschleife in lead and follow mode. So they had two of their Opel DTM drivers. DTM's a German racing series, Manfred Winkelhock and Jochen Mass. And they were going at a pretty good pace, but because they knew where to go, where the lines were, you know, it was a lot safer and easier for us to just follow them. And then after we were done with that, we got to hop in the car with them. They were each driving the Insignia GS, which was the turbocharged 3-liter V6, 300 horsepower, all-wheel drive version of it. And when I rode with Jochen Mass, and it was just a phenomenal experience. You know, I mean, this guy knows the Ring. You know, I mean, he probably not quite as experienced as Sabine Schmitz, but you know, he's driven there countless times, and if you like a thrill ride, you know, if you're in Germany, go there if there's an open day, and either go for a drive or do both. Go for a drive and then take a ride with one of the professionals, and it's unlike any experience you'll ever have automotively. But one of my other experiences riding with a race car driver was actually here in Michigan. In 2010, GM did a small event with just a handful of people at the Milford Proving Grounds. And it was a few days before, the Michigan, NASCAR race in the summer. And, Juan Pablo Montoya, who was driving for, Ganassi Racing in NASCAR at the time, they brought him to Milford, and they had the Corvette ZR1 there, the supercharged LS9 ZR1. And I got to ride for around the Milford Road Course, which is also known as the Lutz Ring. You know, it's this
Lutz Ring, right?
Course that they built in the early 2000s, you know, based on input from Bob Lutz for doing vehicle development. And I had driven that course several times before in Corvettes and in other vehicles, and was relatively familiar with it. But getting into the passenger seat with Juan Montoya was an experience unlike anything else. I mean, he was thrashing that Corvette, you know, where, you know, I was driving quick when I drove it. You know, I was not hanging the back end out, going around corners. I mean, he was just going all out in this thing and just chattering along the entire time.
Right. I think that's the thing that people mentioned about Sabine as well. It's like she could just do it while just being, you know, just, it's like a normal day at the, you know.
Yeah, just totally relaxed.
Yeah. That's crazy.
It's like being in any taxi, in a New York taxi, with a cab driver.
Those guys are pretty badass too. I don't drive around the city that way.
But they're not going anywhere near these kinds of speeds.
No.
Yeah. So it was a pretty amazing experience.
Looking at Sabine's career, just the fact that she can do what not everybody can do with that whole, like, you've got it. You've got the ability to drive and to be fast and to win races, but you've also got the ability to present and to have that kind of personality and to, like, she was on Top Gear and, just not everybody has that sort of racing ability and then just the personality to get out there and get people excited about auto racing and driving and that kind of stuff and tell the story in a really engaging way and have fun with it. There's a lot more racing drivers who are, unfriendly. That's probably a better word than the one that I'm thinking of. It's just, it's a great loss. And I was shocked to find out that she was only 51. It sucks.
Yeah.
I was looking to see if there's anything set up, for, donations or any kind of foundation. I don't think there is, but if one of our listeners knows, certainly, if you have, maybe one of our listeners has been around the ring with Sabine as a taxi driver. Who knows?
Let us know if you've taken a ring taxi drive and share your story. Someone else has just jumped into the Zoom room with us here. Rebecca?
Hello! Greetings. Hello. From the road!
So where are you?
So we're just outside of Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, so you're nowhere.
We are in the middle of nowhere.
Literally.
Our ultimate destination shall continue to remain a mystery, as well as our purpose for driving, because I am still under embargo. So that's why I can't say anything.
Is this a danger for you? Or are we living on the edge right now because you're not really supposed to be talking to us?
We are living so on the edge right now.
So, Rebecca, I noticed you using the plural we. It sounds like you're not alone there. Who's with you?
I am not alone. I have a very special guest, and it is
I'm in the car.
Nicole Wakeland.
Yay!
I'm back.
Hey, Nicole.
Hey. This time I am serving as her co-driver. So I'm flying her with large quantities of Starbucks, making sure she doesn't go stir crazy. And, because it's so exciting driving through Nebraska.
You got the course notes there and reading out.
I do. I'm just screaming out left, slow down, left, brake hard, turn right, left, left. Yeah, I got it.
And we are also accompanied by Lucy.
Her little kitty. Oh.
Hey, Lucy. So,
did you Lucy drug Lucy?
Lucy is, I've established that Lucy is deaf. For better or for worse, I had her at the vet before we left, and she was in otherwise excellent, excellent health, which is amazing for a 16-year-old kitty cat. I'm a big proponent of restraining your pets in the car. So her carrier is attached to the seat. I'm actually going to try and get us on the road.
What are you driving?
So I am driving Sergio. I am driving my Alfa Romeo Stelvio. That I got a few weeks ago that our listeners know about my traumatic purchasing experience. Which then in the end,
right?
I think I told you guys, they actually delivered the car to the house, which was great. It was really, really convenient. And I will say that, for people that are concerned about COVID safety and such, talk to your dealer and be frank with them and you can do everything outside. You can do all your paperwork, everything, from the safety of your home and sitting outside. And then if you want to, they will go through the car with you. If you prefer not to be in the car with somebody, that's fine. They can even stand outside while you play with the different features and such. But, there are ways to deliver a car safely, even in COVID times.
So how is it? How do you like it? You got it all broken in now, right? Are you varying your speed so that you?
I've got, we're varying our speed between almost legal and totally not.
That's what it's made for.
So those are your options. Yeah, but the speed limit out here is 75, which is just delightful.
Yeah, which means that you actually just crank it up to 10 over. You just set it at 90 and just be fine.
That's... Yep, 90 and forget it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. It is interesting. You know, we just made a left-hand turn and somebody actually waited for us to do that, which is interesting.
Oh, wow.
they're so like freakishly nice in the Midwest, like in New Hampshire where they would like cut you off and flip you the bird. Here, they're like, oh no, you're making a wrong turn at a light. Go ahead. I'll wait for you. Like they're so polite. It's unbelievable.
It is.
Are you going to move then? Or do you like to get like, I like it up here when you do that and then you get rolled coal on.
Yeah, exactly, right?
So it is, so we're on I-80 and it is very flat and it is unbelievably windy today. And we can see the tractor trailer sort of swaying. We actually saw a relatively new RV that was being trailered by a pickup truck, right? It was a pickup truck,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pickup truck.
And they had flipped over. Which fortunately we did see people walking around, so everyone seemed to be okay. But now we're on the highway. We're getting up to speed. And
90.
So we may have a lot of wind. If it's too much, we can pull over again. And, you know, but we really just wanted to check in and touch base and introduce Nicole.
Yeah. So we have some news to share, I think, about Nicole, right?
I hope we do. So Rebecca in our grand quest to places we can't announce, she will be leaving the show, as you all know, and I will be trying to step in and fill Rebecca's shoes, which I can also say, I was going to say it, I'm going to say it, to fill her very stinky shoes because she took her shoes off in the car yesterday. Oh my God, I almost died. But yes, I'm going to fill her very stinky shoes.
There's only this one there.
Oh, it's not like you can't even put them in the trunk, right? Because it's the Stelvio, so they're just there. They're just a scent vector. Even if you put them all the way in the back, that's oh well.
Well, no, it is. I historically do not have smelly feet. Just to clarify,
so she's.
But for some reason, this one pair of shoes, it's not okay. Even with me, it's not okay.
It was not okay. It was not okay.
Well, yeah. So, oh my gosh. We're thrilled to have you join the show. I think it's
so. As you guys know, Nicole was a special guest a few weeks ago, and that was a little trial run for us all.
Seems like for now it's something that you enjoy doing. So.
Well,
you get tired of us.
Yeah.
So Nicole is up in your area, Dan. And so what will be cool is that, you know, you guys sometimes have the same cars. It'll be a little bit, you know, there'll be some really an opportunity to compare and contrast your experiences with the same vehicle oftentimes.
Yeah, the exact same vehicle. Oh, which reminds me, did you ever get that Escalade I cheated you out of?
Oh my gosh, I literally had the Escalade this past week and it arrived in my driveway and I was like, it's about time. Thanks a heck of a lot, Dan. Finally, I get this car.
Was it the gray one?
So yeah.
The gray one that I had with
it was sort of a steely gray color.
Yeah.
It was really nice. I loved it. Yeah. That was a fun few days. I felt very baller running around rural New Hampshire in this giant expensive Escalade.
But you did like it though. Right?
I did. I liked it very much. Actually, I really did like it.
I got to ask you something, Nicole. Did you try out the augmented reality display?
I did not. I did not. So I can't speak to that. So I did not.
No. So what is that?
In the instrument cluster, the small touchscreen to the left of the instrument cluster, you can pick between the normal gauge display and maps. And you can also get the AR display where what it does, is it takes the view from the camera behind the windshield that is normally for your forward collision warning. We talked about this last week, I think, or the week before.
Yeah.
It actually displays the camera view in the instrument cluster on that beautiful OLED display in there. And then when you're using navigation, it superimposes the navigation prompts and makes it look like they, you know, so like things like your turns.
Oh, that's
right. This is where you turn. It displays it, you know, floating over the intersection. And I was just curious if you'd had a chance to try it and what your thoughts on that were.
No, I didn't get a chance to try it, but you know what? I did think that the way they had those screens set up, so it's like, you know, the tiny little screen to your left, that, what is it, like a 7-inch, then like a 14, then a 10-inch, and how it curves, that one, it looks like one giant screen, even though it's three. That looked really slick. I really loved how that looked. It looked very of the future. It was a really well-designed screen. I loved how they did it.
We're not huge fans of lots of screens in cars, so the way that Cadillac has done it has been good enough that it's impressed us. I think the few times we've talked about the Escalade on the show, it's been positive. So
I think the way they've done it, it's somehow just like you look at some cars and it's just all you see is screen, and it's like they're so big and there's so much around them and so many buttons that they overwhelm the dashboard. This is very clean, despite being a huge screen or a huge series of screens. It doesn't, you don't even realize that, like, the little piece to the left of the instrument cluster, it takes a second before you realize, like, that actually is still screen. That's, like, more. It's very well done, so it's not this intrusive, overwhelming, like, I'm suddenly sitting, you know, in a video game console with three screens set up. It's really good. I like how they did it.
Yeah, I think the fact that it's not ridiculously tall helps a lot there. So it's, you know, it's wide, but not, but relatively narrow in height. So I think that helps to mitigate some of that being overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, because like if you look at the cars that have the more tablet style screens right in the center of the dash, those are huge. And technically, mm-hmm. that's not as much screen space probably as what you have across the dash and the Escalade, but it overwhelms the dashboard. This doesn't, how they did it, it just doesn't feel, it looks great, but it doesn't feel overwhelming.
So when you get back from your undisclosed location, you'll hopefully still have a chance. Well, I guess it's gone now already, isn't it? You.
What, the Escalade? The Escalade will be disappearing from my driveway, I believe, tomorrow. But then, I don't know, I think, I don't quite know the schedule. I know that's surprising, but I don't quite know the schedule.
That's not surprising.
So I believe that next Friday, which is after I get back from Venture, I'll have an NSX for a long weekend.
Oh, sweet.
She's debuting her first garage entry with the NSX.
My first garage, it'll be the NSX, just a whatever kind of lame whatever car, you know, that's what I'll be talking about.
This is why you become an actoid juror, because
I was gonna say no, it's serious. Since her appearance, Nicole has been christened as the newest North American Car and Truck of the Year juror.
Yeah,
it's very exciting news. It's amazing.
It is exciting. I'm pretty excited about it. So yeah, that made me very happy. I felt quite honored that they said, hey, come join us.
From our listening audience, you're getting an upgrade from Rebecca.
No, you're not. But my feet don't stink as much. You know.
It's a cross grade.
That's much a cross grade. Yeah.
But no, I think we're thrilled to have you on the show, and we're looking forward to seeing all the stuff that you get as a NACTOY juror that we're never going to touch as just plebeian car reviewers. So that'll be interesting.
You might not say that. You never know what I'm going to get. Watch, I'm going to get the most like boring, like dishwater dull cars after this NSX. That's all I'm going to have for a month.
Thank you so much for checking in from the road. Nicole, we are really thrilled to have you joining us, and we are going to miss you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think your audio is starting to break up just a little bit, so okay. I think now is probably a good time to let you guys go and continue the adventure.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Bye, guys.
All right,
have fun. Bye.
As we record this today, it's the 21st of March. An embargo is going to be lifting. So by the time you hear this, the news of this year's Jeep Easter Safari concepts. Every year, they have the Jeep Easter Safari out in Moab in Utah. And it's a gathering of Jeep aficionados. And for the last, I don't know how many years now, Jeep's been putting together a little fleet of special concepts every year to highlight some of the Mopar accessories that they have for the various Jeep models. And they also usually put together a couple of special vehicles, you know, that are non-production, one of which is often a total concept. And then the other one is a resto mod. So this year for the resto mod, Jeep built up what they call the Jeepster Beach. It's a 1968 Jeepster Commando, but underneath that body is the chassis of a brand new JL Wrangler. So it's got modern engine of the same suspension that you can get on a Wrangler Rubicon out of the dealer today, but with that classic Jeepster Commando styling on it.
The Jeepster is one of those sort of phantom Jeeps that not everybody remembers. It's a little bit different. You know, it's I think it's underneath it all is there's the normal Jeep frame, but it's a larger body than like the CJ was. It was more of a, I'm trying to describe it. How would you describe a Jeepster?
if anything, it's, you know, it's closer, I think, in size to a modern Wrangler than the CJs of that era, you know, the 1960s and 1970s, because those things were really small. It is a bit bigger. You know, it's pretty, I think I'd say pretty close in size to a current two-door Wrangler. But it was also the first Jeep that was ever available with a V8 engine. Although I think the Beach actually has the Pentastar V6 in it.
Yeah.
And it's got basically the stock Wrangler Rubicon chassis underneath it. But one of the things that's really cool about this as well is the paint on this thing. They came up with this special color that I was on a briefing call with the Jeep guys earlier this week. And the color of this thing is this gold mica color that is, I guess, you know, is not something that they're going to be reproducing for production, for any production vehicles, because it's way too difficult to do and way too expensive. But it looks awesome on this particular Jeep.
Yeah, and I'm not normally a fan of gold, but I'll agree. It does. It looks really good. What do they call it?
They call it a brightly colored two-tone paint scheme of hazy IPA and zinc oxide.
Hazy IPA. Okay. I mean, sure. I wouldn't describe that as a hazy IPA. Okay. That's fine. I'd need to see it in the sun. They have to send it here so I can check it out. It's funny that they show the Jeepster from the angle that they show it in the pictures too, because it really does have that kind of Wrangler look to it. But when you see a Jeepster out in the wild, it looks weird. And
they are a little unusual looking because the back end is longer than a classic Jeep. And the, you know, instead of the vertical rear end, it's got a forward sloping rear end. So it's an interesting looking vehicle. And they didn't build them for that long, but it's pretty cool.
When were they originally built? They were Kaiser era, right? Yeah, so like late 60s through 70s, like mid 70s.
I think so, yeah. And sorry, I was mistaken. This one actually has the 2-liter turbo 4-cylinder, not the Pentastar V6. And they did do some different calibrations on this one. So they bumped the power and torque by about 25% to 340 horsepower and 369 pounds-feet of torque.
Well, that should be enough.
Yeah. It'll do.
The other Jeep concept that they released for the Easter Safari is the Magneto. That's a battery electric Wrangler.
It is. Basically. Yeah. So right now, Jeep is just launching the Wrangler 4xe, which is a plug-in hybrid that you can go out and buy. But the Magneto is basically a prototype for a future full battery electric Jeep. It's based on the two-door Wrangler. Design-wise, the body is pretty much stock Wrangler. It doesn't look dramatically different. It's got a pretty cool white and blue paint job on it. And they took four of the battery packs from the 4xe, from the plug-in hybrid. So that's, I think, about a 13-kilowatt-hour battery pack. And they've installed those. One is in the back. One's in the back. Two are underneath the body. And then one is in the front under the hood. And they haven't given a whole lot of details on the specs of this thing, but it's pretty clear it is actually equipped with a 6-speed manual transmission.
Yeah, that was the weird part, and I think Jalopnik actually picked up on it too, because there had been a release of the a cutaway image that showed the powertrain layout, and they were like, "Wait a minute, why is there a transmission in there?"
Yeah, well, the thing they talked about with this, you know, is you basically only use the clutch to shift gears. And then when you're out on the trail, because an electric motor makes its peak torque from 0 RPM, you can pick whatever gear you want. And then you don't have to touch the clutch again. You just crawl through, you know, at zero speed. And one of the specs that they mentioned was that you can crawl so slowly with this thing that you can go about 5 feet in 1 minute, which is crazy. I mean, that's how slow this thing can crawl.
I have days just by modulating
the accelerator pedal.
Yeah. We look, sometimes it's hard to get out of bed. Actual production reality is like, do you think that they would build, because it seems like it's easy enough too, to just retrofit an electric motor to the existing rest of the powertrain, but that's not the most cost-effective way to do it. I'm questioning whether they would actually build it that way if they were to build it as a retrofit kit or something.
Most likely when a production Wrangler battery electric does arrive, it will be without a transmission, or, you know, just with a single speed reduction gearbox. Actually, I wouldn't be surprised if they did use a 2-speed transfer case, you know, because for a Wrangler, you want those really low crawl ratios. And that, you know, that's something you need when you're crawling through, you know, over boulders and through trails. So they would probably, you know, maybe keep a 2-speed transfer case with a 4-wheel drive low range, but probably without the transmission in there. Actually, just looking through the press release, which was only just released, the 4 battery packs total up to 70 kilowatt hours, and it's running on an 800 volt electrical system. And one of the things that Jeep is doing right now is they are actually installing solar powered EV chargers at a variety of trails, popular trails where Jeep owners often go, including the Rubicon Trail in California, as well as out in Moab, to enable owners of the 4xe to go there, you know, charge up before they head out on the trail. And, you know, then they'll have, you know, about 20 odd miles of electric driving capability, so they can be out on the trail with zero emissions and, you know, be really quiet, which is, I think, a really cool thing to do. And actually, Rivian also just announced that they are building out an EV charging network. They're at Rivian Adventure Network, I think they're calling it, and putting DC fast chargers at locations, you know, where people are going to, you know, expected to go off-roading with Rivian trucks. And they'll be building out that network over the next 2 years. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this, you know, people trying to be, you know, have a little bit lighter footprint on the environment when they're doing their outdoor adventuring.
Right. Don't drive through water, not because they're electric, but because you churn up the habitat. Stop doing that. Stop fording streams. I don't know. I do one of these days intend to spend more time off-road with a proper off-road vehicle, doing proper off-roading, which is here in more heavily regulated Massachusetts. Not exactly a legal thing you can do. You can't just go off on the trails.
Here in northern Michigan, you can do that.
Yeah, you can't do that in Massachusetts. Like the thing that everybody says, because we've talked about this among fellow car riders, I'm like, hey, where do you take your 4x4s to really try them out? And it's usually along power lines. And the trick is always like, don't get caught.
Yeah.
So I'm a little hesitant to go into somebody else's right of way with a vehicle that also belongs to somebody else and then potentially get stuck in need of rescue. So,
yeah, that could be a problem.
Yeah, that's my story. So with solar chargers at trails, that's great if there's enough battery storage capacity to.
Well, and that's one of the things they'll be doing is putting in battery storage, stationary battery storage there to enable higher power charging. Cause you're not going to be able to get high power charging just off the solar panels.
Of course, with a standby diesel generator, just in case.
I don't know what Rivian's plan is. Jeep is not going to be doing that, I don't think. They're just solar.
Just solar at all with no sort of grid-tied backup or anything? Like that's interesting as well.
I think it depends on where they are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of these places, there isn't power to hook up.
That's true. And we don't need to create more of a disaster bringing power into those places. That's interesting. Yeah. That actually is something I'm probably equally interested in as the cars. It's just, what are you going to do with that charging infrastructure that you set up with solar alone? Because it's great, but when you're trying to charge a lot of cars real quick at 800 volts, like that's a lot of capacity. So that's,
well, and this is the thing we're going to see everywhere increasingly with chargers. As we try to move more and more of the charging infrastructure to renewable sources, and also as we're getting higher power charging, you know, the challenge with doing high power DC fast charging is that's a big strain on the grid. There's actually more than enough generating capacity in the U.S. to support going completely electric. The problem is the distribution and getting it, you know, at the times when you want it and getting enough of it at, you know, in one quick shot. You know, if you're doing 350 or even higher, 350 kilowatt or even higher power charging, like as we get into electrifying trucks, they're working on megawatt charging systems for trucks. That requires a lot of power coming in. Most places don't necessarily have that ability to support that, you know, on a consistent basis. So we are going to see all of these chargers increasingly being equipped with batteries that can be charged at a lower rate. So you don't have to do as much capacity upgrade on the grid feeding that charging station.
Yeah.
You can charge it at a lower rate and then pull it out quickly when you need it to charge a vehicle.
Yeah, because if there's one thing that public utilities or utility companies, not necessarily public, love to do, it's under maintain their infrastructure. So when you start to use it to charge cars, that's great. That's nice strain on stuff that's like hasn't been touched in 60 years and then starts fires.
Yeah, especially in California.
Yeah.
We got one more story related to EVs. Last Monday, Volkswagen had their first Power Day, which is their equivalent of Tesla's Battery Day that they had last fall. And they made some interesting announcements. And this is a lot of it is consistent both with what Tesla has announced, but also what some other automakers are doing. And when we started getting into modern EVs a decade ago, aside from Tesla, but even Tesla at the time, you know, automakers weren't pursuing the idea of building their own battery manufacturing capacity. This is something that they were largely doing in conjunction with suppliers, because first of all, you know, at the beginning, you know, volumes weren't enough to justify building their own batteries, you know, battery production. They also didn't know enough about the technology at the time. They mostly worked with companies like LG Chem and Panasonic and Samsung and CATL and SK Innovation and had them build the cells for them. But now, as we're getting into this decade, the volume of EVs being sold every year is growing. Automakers increasingly are recognizing that both motors and batteries need to be one of their core competencies, just like internal combustions and transmissions have been in the past. And as they get away from building engines and designing new engines and transmissions, they're shifting to batteries and motors. They are increasingly bringing the battery production in-house. GM last year announced their Ultium battery system, their joint venture with LG Chem to produce lithium-ion cells. The first plant's going up in Ohio right now. They're planning for a second plant, probably in Tennessee. Ford has recently talked about, you know, starting to do their own in-house cell production instead of relying on suppliers. And for Volkswagen, they have, at their Power Day, announced that they were going to start producing their own cells as well. They currently buy cells from all those major suppliers, from CATL, Samsung, SK Innovation, and LG Chem. They will be starting to produce their own cells. They've got a plant going up in northern Sweden, in Skellefteå, Sweden, which is going to be the first. But over the course of, by 2030, they plan to build 6 cell production facilities just in Europe with a total of 240 gigawatt hours a year of cell capacity. And that is a lot. Certainly a lot compared to what we have right now in the U.S.
But it's right, what was it you were telling me or before we started the show? That's less than a quarter of what's actually needed for just the U.S. like sales volume.
Yeah. So for the U.S., you know, if we get back to 17 million vehicles a year, annual sales, right now we have about 40 gigawatt hours of cell production capacity. Most of that, about 35, is with Tesla and Panasonic in Nevada. And most of the rest is LG Chem at a plant here in Michigan. But if we want to build 17 million EVs a year in the U.S., we're going to need somewhere between 1 and 1.5 terawatt hours. So that's about 40 times the capacity we have now.
I was off by like an exponential factor. Look at that. Me and the math don't get along. Yeah.
So Volkswagen's doing the same in Europe. You know, they're going to be at 240. That'll cover a lot of their own internal production needs for Europe. But, you know, then there's also China and North America and other parts of the world. So the big thing this decade is going to be building battery cell manufacturing facilities and also recycling. Because if you're going to build that many batteries, you're going to need a hell of a lot more raw materials than we have available right now in terms of, you know, capacity for that. One of the other big things they talked about was recycling. The raw materials right now represent the bulk, you know, more than two thirds of the cost of a cell. And that's, you know, things like the lithium, nickel, manganese, cobalt. VW already has a pilot plant up and running in Germany that's doing recycling. And there's a cool video that I'll include a link to in the show notes that shows they've got this giant shredder, and they actually take complete battery modules, drop them in the shredder, and it shreds them into these little pieces. And then there's a whole process it goes through to extract all the raw materials, to separate all the raw materials again. And they think they can get to 95% recovery of the raw materials that they can then put back into production of new cells.
That sounds energy intensive. And that's sort of my, that's where my skepticism sets in a little bit. Just that, like the idea of recycling, you know, we've been sold the idea of plastics recycling, which is mostly nonsense, and was from the get-go. And that's sort of now coming more to light is like, yeah, you can kind of recycle plastic, but it costs so much on the energy input that it's actually not efficient and not really viable. I wonder if that's the same thing they're going to run into. It seems like battery materials and the electrolytes and all that are so much more valuable that it's not a ruse. They actually need to recycle the stuff, but I don't know. Maybe I'm
yeah. And yeah. And that is absolutely a challenge that needs to be overcome. They think they can do it. It's, you know, given the cost of these materials, it is, you know, they are going to have to recycle somehow. They, you know, they've developed processes that they think can make it economically viable. And the other aspect of this as well, or, you know, other parts of this, you know, is they've got this, during the presentation, they talked about the circular economy, you know, of, you know, from the initial product going through the whole life cycle and then recirculating as much of that back into that process, continuing that process going forward. So, you know, from cell production, you know, they have first life use in the vehicles. When the capacity drops to a point where it's no longer useful in a vehicle, reusing that for second life. And we talked before about, you know, putting batteries, stationary batteries at charging stations. This is one of the big applications that's going to be needed for those second life batteries. Once you take those modules out of a car, you know, you can, they can still be very useful sitting next to a charger or for other types of stationary storage applications. Finally, when it's done there, then going through that recycling and starting the whole process again. And then the other thing that VW committed to doing is installing 18,000 new DC fast chargers in Europe over the next several years. So, you know, they are really diving all in into the whole electric strategy over the next decade.
Well, and the ID4 has been making the rounds as well. People are starting to see them and get up and close with them. That's changing opinions as well. Just seeing the design and the quality and the way those have been put together, I've seen a lot of positive reports on Volkswagen's EV efforts after they nearly killed us all with diesel, which is not true. But we really need that charging infrastructure here. Everybody has a pretty viable EV, has a pretty good EV now. Charging, on the other hand, is it's not as easy as going to a gas station, like Rebecca said. You know, you still need to plan it out and to take a more active role in that, which is fine at this stage of EV adoption because you're a believer when you buy an EV right now. So you're willing to do that work, but getting it to be as convenient or as easy as a gas station is, we're not there yet. And so hopefully I know Volkswagen has Electrify America. Hopefully they continue to add charging infrastructure here. That's not like some level two charger tucked around the corner of some building you can't find.
That is something that we will see a lot more expansion of, is the charging infrastructure. And it is a problem right now, you know, and it's a classic example of the William Gibson line. You know, the future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good line.
Depending on where you go, charging can either be no problem at all, or it can be a huge problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we want EVs to be ubiquitous, we have to make it not a problem at all. You know, especially for people in cities. And this is one of the things that, VW talked about, you know, is making sure that, that you can support EV adoption by people living in urban areas, where a lot of people don't live in single family homes with a garage,
right?
You know, that they are going to have to rely on public charging. And, you know, things like, you know, Rivian's announcement of, you know, putting in 10,000 chargers, you know, will help. Although one thing, I'm going to be writing a blog post about this, for my company blog. You know, one of the unfortunate things about the Rivian announcement is that their DC fast chargers are going to be exclusively for Rivian owners, which I think is a terrible idea.
I thought that they were going to be compatible with other vehicles as well.
As far as I know, they are compatible. They're using CCS connectors, but they just aren't going to allow other owners of other vehicles to charge at their DC fast chargers,
yeah,
which I think is stupid. I think, you know, if they want to give free charging or discounted charging to their owners, fine. But I think, you know, if they really want to help the adoption of EVs overall, then, you know, I think that they need to make their, I think everybody needs to make their charging networks open to everybody.
Wait. These are startup companies, right? And they're building charging infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you not turn that into a revenue stream?
I know. Like, exactly.
They don't have are revenue negative. They don't have any, they're not making money. They're financed by companies that are like people.
Like Amazon.
They're just losing money in a calculated bet that they will eventually make money. Don't you want to try to eventually make money faster? Okay.
Yeah. No, I can't argue with that.
I mean, you know, the urban charging is an issue for renters and just for how cars are used and stored in cities. That's something that's got to get worked out. And that's really the most common point of pain and contention that comes up when we talk about this stuff. And it's always like, well, yeah, how am I going to charge a car in the city? I live in an apartment and my car isn't near me. It's a mile away or whatever. And we need to make sure that we're moving like parallel paths. You can't over perfect before you launch. The cars are viable. The charging is viable. It doesn't mean that it's perfect, but it means you should get it out there so that people can experience it and you can fine tune it. You know, I've been a part of projects that you wind up just going around in circles for like years. I swear to God, I rewrote the same website 3 or 4 times over the course of 5 years, and it never launched because it was just, you're trying to just do too much and make it too perfect before it launches, and it's never going to be perfect. So go out there with like the idea of being humble and, you know, here's how we thought it should be. Find the ways it needs to change and evolve while people start to use it. Like, you're just going to get that much further down the road. You know, because right now EVs are great for people in the suburbs who do the normal, like, one person in a car commute to a city kind of thing. But that's a really crappy use for any car, no matter how it's propelled, versus, you know, ways to make mobility possible. So I like the greater focus, if you zoom out a little bit, on mobility. And I really want them to solve that urban charging problem. And I haven't seen anything that's exciting yet.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing some interesting things in Europe. BMW has done some stuff with some pilots with using light poles, street side light poles,
yeah,
and installing chargers in there within the poles because they already have power, you know, making that available to people, you know, for curbside parking, things like that, you know, or, you know, where we have parking meters today, you know, install chargers, you know, at those positions. But a lot more needs to be done. And, you know, part of it that'll help is, you know, making faster charging more accessible and available or affordable. But there's still a lot that needs to happen to really make the switch to EVs viable.
Yeah, well, you know, the common complaint too is going to be, well, who's going to pay for it? And we can pay for it.
Yeah.
We already subsidize our highways. And the idea that any other competing system has to operate at a profit or break even is what has hamstrung transit across the nation as well. One of the things, there's a lot of different reasons, yeah. But this is an investment we can make.
And, you know, it doesn't all have to be paid for by tax dollars. You know, there's plenty of private companies that are interested in getting into this business. But what, you know, what we need to do is find ways, I think, to make it easier, you know, to look at the permitting processes and things like that, make it easier for infrastructure to be installed and make it accessible to people.
Yeah. So let's go. Let's do it. We'll,
all right.
we'll agitate for it. Yes, I'm good at agitation. all right. Do we have any questions, or are we just done with the show at this point?
Why don't we wrap it up for this week and get back to questions next week?
Okay. And maybe Nicole will be with us next week. Maybe. I don't know if she survives her trip.
I'm not sure when she's getting back, but we'll see. She'll either be with us next week or the week after.
All right. And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you next time.
All right. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Wheel Bearings. Hey, we love to listen to our listeners, too. Drop us an email to feedback@wheelbearings.media with your thoughts, questions, or conversation starters. That's feedback@wheelbearings.media. You can also find us on Twitter @wheelbearingscast. Don't use any vowels except for the A in cast. So that's WHLBRNGS cast. Thanks again. We hope to hear from you soon.